Hello there, and welcome to our podcast, Conversations in Noosa. My name is John Caruso. Growing up as a young boy with a passion for art in a big country town in the 60s meant that my next guest felt somewhat like an outsider. People kept telling him that he was different, and he says that he struggled with the school system from year four onwards. Those challenges, however, didn't stop Lou Brennan from becoming a community leader, a local government councillor, and a much sought-after artist. If you're familiar with Lou's art, you know that it is extremely intricate and detailed. It's a passion that he commits to daily, working away in his private space on his property in Kurran. Your job can often define who you are. So I started the podcast by asking Lou Brennan who he felt he was.
I can't answer that question, and I would love to, and I've thought about answering that question most of my life. I can't even put myself in a box. How weird is that? If somebody said, okay, so what are you about? And one sentence only, it would be the length of a dictionary, that one sentence, you know, and not grammatically correct. It's weird. I mean, I don't understand why it is that it's hard to describe who and what I am. I just do things. I do things.
But what do you feel you are?
Well, I've been an artist since I was able to hold a pencil. And that's driven me through, you know, pretty much everything I've done in my life has had a strong creative element to it. But I didn't know that. I was just doing things, you know. And so even from when I was a kid, you know, uncles and aunts and friends of friends or whoever, and then growing right through everything that I've ever done, people have said to me, you're different. And I'm going, really? You know, I don't know what that, I didn't know what that meant. And so I started to put it down as, okay, so I'm creative. But it seems like at the same time I was industrious and hardworking and focused, and that's where I think it becomes complex. Because it's easy to label artists as freewheeling and, you know, in a dreamlike state and, you know, having a nice bohemian lifestyle, but I didn't ever fit in with that categorization in any way or form. You know, I was sort of even quite driven around my art. And looking back, I probably should have been more bohemian, you know, if I was going to be an artist all of my life.
Why?
You ask all the hard questions early, don't you? You know, but when I was young, it was very hard to make a living out of art. There was probably five people in Australia making a living out of art. And I was selling art from 14-year-old. So I understood the commercial issues from then. And I remember, you know, some very encouraging words. Sir Joshua Smith was twice Archibald winner. He saw one of my drawings in my aunt's house in Sydney and said, this is the finest drawing I've ever seen in my life. I was 14. You know, I was comfortable with the direction I was taking with my art, which was heavily focused on realism. And by the age of 14, I had already discovered the American Super Realists, which was a great relief to a young artist who was surrounded by an obsession in Australia with abstract art. So again, you know, here was this dichotomy where Australia was heavily committed to abstraction through galleries and through art schools and things like that. I had rejected that as a concept from when I was young. I'm going, well, that's not for me. You know, I love realism. I love old school. I love, you know, classical Greco-Roman drawing, you know, all of those things. Fortunately, they were around my house. You know, my art side comes from my mother's side and my great-grandfather in particular, who was a great artist. And so I was surrounded by books and there was art on the walls, and not expensive art, but there was enough there for me to dig into constantly whenever I wanted to, you know, and it kept leading me back to the great artists of all time, in my view, the ones that were written up for their ability to draw and their ability to paint in a traditional sense. And that's where I always wanted to be. But it was a lonely old road for a young guy in Australia in the 60s and 70s that loved realism, hyper-realism and classical art. You know, nobody wanted to know you.
Do you think your life would have been different if you'd given yourself over to that bohemian lifestyle that you mentioned earlier?
Yeah, and it was there, you know. Like the 60s for a young guy was just tremendous time. You know, I was very excited about the poster art in America and the changes to the world and politics in the world of the day and how that influenced art and artists of the day, you know, even the modern artists, despite that I didn't want to be like them and I didn't quite understand the success that they were carrying through their art. I still appreciated the changes and it was very, very exciting stuff. And, you know, out here in Australia, it was a little bit hard to grasp in reality unless you became that bohemian and hanging around the back streets in Melbourne or Sydney or something and doing coffee shops and talking to gallery owners. And I was a boy from Brisbane, which at the time was the biggest country town in Australia. And I loved that. I loved Brisbane growing up there. It was just like Huckleberry Finn, fantastic. You know, we were on the river on the south side at Yeronga and in a suburb that was completely made up of boys and we just played footy and built rafts and did stuff, you know, it was great. But
is that where you grew up, in Brisbane?
Yeah, grew up in Brisbane.
Because you mentioned as a 14-year-old you were in Sydney, but you didn't know.
No, I wasn't in Sydney, no. I was in Brisbane.
Right.
But I was saying I think the successful artists of the era and even to this day mostly come out of Sydney and Melbourne or are associated with galleries in Sydney and Melbourne or are associated with people of influence in the art sphere in Sydney or Melbourne. You know, like the Sydney Boys Club is a cliche that's used often around those who manipulate the art market in Australia. It's a loose term, but it's, I think, based on some reality.
So you mentioned that your parents were also passionate artistic people?
My mother.
Your mother.
My dad was an engineer in every sense of the word. Yeah. He was, and my brother, you know, so I was, again, like, you're different, you know. So I didn't want to go down that path. I had fantastic arguments and discussions, you know, in a house full of great debaters, you know, that were very strong in their character.
So was it your dad and your brother then that gave you that industrious side? To go, well, I've got the artistic side, but yeah. I probably need to get some kind of 9-to-5 job to make a living.
Oh, yeah. And look, I was, you know, I think because I didn't fit in at school.
Why is that, Lou?
Well, I think we just covered that. You know, I was different.
Oh, but in terms of the art, but I mean, I heard, you know, you were a surfer, you hung out with the other boys, you played footy, you did all that kind of. To me, that sounds like any other.
Well, I went to school for sport.
Queensland kid that grew up, you know.
Yeah, except, you know, like the education system and I didn't get along from about grade 4, like the actual education system. You know, since then, I've done my very best to see that there's some changes in education in our region. Because of that, I guess. You know, there was no art programs for boys in schools. You know, it took me quite a lot of effort, even through our senior year, to convince the principal of our school, which was a big school, Yeronga High, 1,400 kids, that boys should be allowed into the art class. I mean, it was a different world. And he told me straight up, you're only going to do that so you can get out of real work. It was a hard old battle to get anywhere in that realm. I didn't mind a battle, it seems, and still don't mind a battle. Yeah. And eventually got into an art class, but didn't find it that worthwhile anyway. But I was selling T-shirts that I was making and I was selling posters and, you know, doing stuff.
How old were you?
Yeah, I was 14, 15, stuff, selling some art around the neighbourhood, you know, winning some prizes for.
How did you feel at that stage? My son at 8, he loves to dabble, you know, and yeah, obviously you're very open to the direction they might take in the future. But he won first prize at the Yamundi show and he got $24 for this painting that he did last year, the year before.
That's huge.
And I could say, well, I could see that light globe moment, you know, when he bought it and he got the $24 on parade. And I said, well, you created that and you got paid. Mm. And I saw the light globe go on where he went, you mean I can create some art and get paid for it?
Yeah.
Do you remember how you felt when you first sold something that you'd created, that you'd made?
I'd won a prize at the Royal National Association Art Competition. I'd entered three things. One was a watercolour of a Formula One race car. It was quite large and poster-like. One was a completely abstract, psychedelic-type piece that, you know, in my mind I'd absolutely created, but I pulled elements out of the psychedelic posters of the day, you know, around, you know, the Jimi Hendrix stuff and all of the things that were going on in the music world, which I was fascinated with. And the third thing I did was a portrait of an American Indian woman and her child in pastel and very real, which I still have. And the abstract ink drawing got the prize. It was probably $24, or it might have been less. And it sort of shook me in a way that the two pieces that I thought were, you know, as best as I could do in an art sense, didn't get a look in, you know. The light on moment came, and, you know, my mum was very proud of the fact that I'd picked up a prize. It was all very exciting. It was a big show. And it came at me from all directions. Oh, you really don't want to go down that pathway as an artist. There's not a lot of opportunity there. You know, it came from family, friends, relatives.
Trying to discourage you.
They did discourage me. I took some strength from that in the fact that they're saying, if you go to art school, like the judge at the show suggested I do, and there was very few art schools around in Brisbane in those days, then we want to encourage you to do more of that, the abstract. Of course, it was Australia in the 60s.
The world in the 60s.
The world in the 60s.
Sergeant Pepper and all that stuff. Sure.
Well, at least they had some form, you know. That's why I love the album art. You know, there was some form around it, you know, whereas, you know, you look at Roscoe and the gang and they're just doing shit. And, you know, are we allowed to say that?
Of course.
I look, you know, squares on a piece of canvas and, you know, they were propped up by the money people in New York and there was a game going and lots of money changed hands. And so anyway, I decided not to go to art school and to continue on just chipping away at the commercialization of my art as best as I could anyway.
I love that you talk about the kind of abstract and psychedelic stuff in that way, knowing the really intricate and detailed work that you do today. And the subject matter, you did a lot of horses and the close-ups. How long does it take you to create something like that? That to me, that would be a year, half a year? I mean, it's intense, though,
isn't it?
It's so detailed.
It is intense, and it's detailed. And people see it in life rather than a photo on an iPhone.
Well,
you know.
Well, that's all I've seen. I've seen photos online. So to see it for real must just blow you away or blow other people away.
It does. Yeah. You know, it's one of the great joys of my life is to see people and their expression when they look at my work in reality. And, you know, there's a pattern to it. You know, they just look, then they'll look again, probably the third look, and they start walking towards it in some sort of mesmerized state. It's beautiful.
Yeah,
I really love it. And then they're in awe. And then I've had some people start to tear up. I've had, you know, like it amazes me to this day when you see that happen. It doesn't happen for everybody, but. And so even though they're horses, aside from that, it's the ability to transfer emotion through reality that is my obsession with art.
That must move you more than anything else, though. You talked about someone that sees one of yours in a gallery or hanging up, and if you're moved, if you have that strong emotion reaction to it where it moves you to tears, that's the ultimate,
yes,
what you've created
to
have that impact on another human being.
Absolutely. You know, it doesn't come, you know, I'm not answering letters and cards every day of the week from around the world, but they come, you know, and people are moved by the things that I do, and I'm sure other artists get the same, but, you know, a depiction of an animal that you can present in such a way that it's moving is a real challenge. It's not only the challenge of the detail, it's the challenge of capturing the character of the animal, it's the challenge of capturing the power of that particular animal, the horse, you know, and then for all of that to come together and be accessible from a human point of view as a viewer, that's the game plan for me, you know, and it doesn't have to be a horse. But whatever I do, I try and transgress between the art and the viewer, that emotive element.
I think I saw on Facebook you had an exhibition in Melbourne recently, in the last year, 18 months?
I have an ongoing – I have galleries down there that look after my work in an ongoing sense. October, there is an exhibition of equestrian work at Mount Eliza, Man Young Gallery. So I'm a regular there. Also, I just put a portrait of Barry Charles down at Mornington. There's not a standalone Lou Brennan exhibition as such, but
a number of galleries
down there. Yeah.
Considering that the work is so intense and so intricate and so detailed, and obviously you enjoy it and there's that great emotion and passion for it, is it something you do for fun though, Lou? Does it relax you when you do something like that that's so detailed?
A great question. My daughter-in-law pointed out, because I've got the studio on the farm and it's, I don't know, 50 metres from the house, and the gang were all hanging out, and And she said, have a look at that. There's a cow trail in the grass where you go to the studio and back every day. So it's all still grassed, but there's a depression where I walk back and forward, which was an indication of how often I go there. And every time I go there, I get pleasure. So, yes.
So it is a source of enjoyment.
Absolutely. The answer is absolutely yes, for a range of reasons, but the space is fantastic. It's not elaborate, but it's a beautiful space to walk into. I love the challenge. Whatever is on the easel or the wall at the time, there's nothing overly easy that I do these days in my art. It's a complex thing.
And how much time would you spend on it? Like, would you go there daily?
I try to, but I don't get there daily.
Yeah.
But if I'm locked onto a significant piece, yes, daily until it's completed, day and night. Yeah, and that's a beautiful thing.
Looking back on your career and your life now and moving away from the artistic side of things, Lou, does that time in local government seem like just I've heard it somewhere, but like a comma in the sentence of time? This seems like a very short period of time for you.
No, it was actually a part of my life. It just so happened that I got elected, but...
what do you say, like you weren't expecting?
Yeah, like it's true. We live in a small town, Coran. When we first got married and moved there, it was just a tiny little village. There was, mostly railway workers. The railway station still had a railway office. It had had a general store, old Mr. and Mrs. Bish down the corner. He wore a bib and brace. He was about 6'3" and skinny, and everything still had pounds, shillings and pence on the price tag.
Yeah.
It was a sweet town, but very small. But there was a coincidence in the sense that a lot of young people like us were sort of moving to towns like that. And so things started to happen, including, we had children, two sons, and there was a little tiny school there and it had 24 kids. And then around about that time, it started to grow. There was some wonderful, what we'd call now is mentors, but they were just great families around us that helped us along. As two young, like 23-year-olds making our way in life in a village. Next thing you know, the principal of the school said, I think you'd better be the next president of the PNC. And I'm flat out building a family and a farm and a house and a business and had no idea what it meant. And that was the beginning of the commitment to the community from that day.
Yeah. Well, he obviously must have seen something in you and gone, look, he's a leader. He's going to get things done.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But
other people saw it in you and went, he's our man.
And then there was no turning back. We had a lot of fun. We raised a lot of money. We did a lot of things for the school. And then it was work on the Coran Recreation Club, which we just built out of my wife's cousin's house after he was killed in a motorbike accident. We moved Greeny's house down to the Oval, which was the tip many years ago, created a football field, cricket field, community house, and then, of course, you have to be the president of that for 5 years. And then the kids wanted to do swimming, so you resurrect the down-and-out swimming club in Pomona because a whole lot of mothers ask you to, and so you get the kids going and you get the swim club going, and there are some magnificent lessons to me of how to actually get things happening, about needing good people around you and about, a free hat. I came up with my own little term, free hat, like people can't do things voluntarily forever without reward. And once you understand that principle, then you can keep community organizations going happily for quite some time, And they're very organic. There's highs and lows in every one of them. But as long as they're getting some small return on their time investment, they're all happy campers.
And are these all achievements for you, Lou, as president of the PNC or once you're elected as a councillor for local government?
Oh, these are all pre-council. Yeah. And it was out of all of those activities, PNC, rec club, swim club, all those things that you're doing after you've... looking back, I don't know how I actually did it. And I don't mean I achieved all those things. But even just to turn up, we decided that we were going to, my wife was a lover of horses, which is followed through into the articles. So we were breeding quarter horses, we were raising cattle, we were building the house, we were building cattle yards and fencing, we were planting crops, I was going to work 5-6 days a week in the construction industry, which is my background. Then you'd go to meetings three nights a week and make things happen. It was just like, it's like the beginning of the Star Wars movie where all the stars just, you know, I don't know how we all did
and
it.
And you're raising kids. Yeah.
So I don't know how we did it, but we had a lot of fun along the way. It was part of the deal.
Was your wife happy for you to run as a counsellor?
Well, we didn't know what it meant.
Yeah.
You know. We didn't know how big a step it was going to be. But Bob Abbott came to me and he said one day in the street in Pomona, he said, and we'd had Bob as our counsellor for some years. He loved politics. He's the consummate politician. He came to me and he said, Lou, I'm going to run for mayor and I think you should run for council. I'm going, what does that mean? You know, I had no idea. Away we went. I got elected by 48 votes.
Your first run.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was only because of all the stuff I'd been doing anyway.
Of course. But that's the kind of the grassroots stuff, isn't it? To get your name out there, to get known.
Well, I didn't do it for that reason.
No, I know. But it seemed like a natural progression.
It wasn't, accidentally. Or once again, you know, Bob could see that you're doing all this work. You might as well, you know, step to the next rung on the ladder and perhaps do a bit more, you know.
Yeah. Looking back on your career as a councillor, because then you were also a councillor for the amalgamated, Sunshine Coast Council.
Yep.
What are you most proud of in terms of your achievement?
Look, staying honest is number one tick in amongst that crowd. You know, I don't mean Sunshine Coast. There's some great lessons in humanity in that game. I think making things happen is why I was there for 15 years. And I said to Maureen and I said to those who wanted to listen, the only way I want to get elected is because of achievements. And I'd say my experience, 60 to 70% of people who are elected to councils or even government, after they're elected, it seems to me that their whole entire reason for being is to get re-elected. And I had no interest in that unless I was making things happen and achieving things alongside of a lot of good people. So away we went, you know, but, you know, the very first thing was to get a skateboard bowl in Kerrang. Massive achievement in 1997 for a council that had very limited funds. You know, I think they had in those days, probably an annual turnover of $80 million total. And then once I learned that, it was like, yahoo, you know, let's go. But, you know, I think towards the end, the last term of council was particularly rewarding, which was Sunshine Coast. And to have a $14 million library built in Karoi, which I'd been working on since 1998 when we did a review
it's
of
a
libraries.
Great library, that one.
It took our national award. And I wasn't around to, you know, to be invited to that presentation. But that's a massive, like, it was a part of an economic strategy that I put together and worked very hard to see the first economic development strategy for Noosa embedded into a policy, because there was none and we needed one. We needed some serious direction around what was going on. And so I did a whole lot of research and looked at some of the very best performers in the world and got an understanding of how difficult it was to drive an economy in a tourist-based coastal region. And I took myself to Bologna and got an understanding of how Emilia-Romagna in Italy was the highest performing region in Europe for over 1,000 years. And they had no raw materials and they didn't even have tourism. And, you know, I just needed to know how we could see a reasonable future in this district, and people had an opportunity, and young people had an opportunity to stay here if they wanted and get work if they wanted.
Without relying on the tourism industry.
Yeah. It became a passion. Yeah, I'm sure I offended most people in the tourist industry.
So do you miss it? Do you miss those
I miss achieving things, building libraries in small towns when you're told that will never happen.
I did talk to you earlier about your art and about how that does relax you. But do you do anything else in terms, as far as a hobby goes? I know you play the guitar and...
Yeah. Look, you know, it's sort of life now. You know, getting on, I'm well into my 30s now. you know, I have two wonderful sons and the most beautiful daughters-in-law in the fullest sense. You know, we're very, very fortunate. And we have our first grandchild, and she is...
Congratulations.
I'm not biased.
When did that happen?
7 months ago.
Really?
You know, there is all of that we love. And we're lucky enough that, you know, they still talk to us and enjoy our company, you know, which is great. A lot of our fun is spent at home barbecuing and relaxing and you know, not only with them, but their friends and stuff. It's an extended gang.
I know you used to talk proudly of your boys when we used to get together once a week on ABC local radio. Is one of your sons, tell me the connection between one of your sons, is he a designer or a jewellery designer? And is it Liam Hemsworth? Or there's too many Hemsworths around. I don't... But my wife mentioned it to me that there was some connection.
Isn't it funny how the girls know each of the Hemsworths personally? I mean, they can describe every lock of hair or what, you know. Like,
I know one's Thor. That's about it. That's as far as it goes.
As a parent, it's just a dream come true to watch your sons develop in the way they have. Lee has more of the creative element in his blood, it seems. He did a dual trade with my good friend Al Geimer in carpentry and joinery, so had some amazing skills. And they were doing anything and everything. Alan, you know, he's just so talented and creative himself, from building, you know, the new Wyber Bridge and the Apollonian Hotel and restaurants and then the finest of joinery in the joinery at Curran, which is a 100-year-old joinery that he bought, you know, in silky oak doors and windows, like, you know, and cupboards and, you know, like in the old school. So my son had the advantage of learning all of that and then went off and earned a lot of money doing remote work and bought a house. He was 23 or something, bought a house in Tewantin. And then it all hit him and he decided he needed a break, which he did, and he headed off with a backpack and a telephone in his hand and met up with all of his friends and travelled the world. Had a terrible accident in Vancouver after about 18 months on the road. We nearly lost him. And he came home after he was able to get home spent some time at home with us recuperating and decided at that point he was going to do his own thing from that day forward and started designing and building his own furniture out of recycled hardwood and metal and steel and stuff, and then started designing and making his own rough cast jewellery, mostly out of stainless steel, things like that, but very masculine jewellery, not the, you know, the finer items for the females. He kept at it and kept at it until he thought he had a product that was saleable and presentable. And we packed up one weekend and drove down to Bangalore up behind Byron Bay and put it on the footpath and knocked on the door of the Island Lux team, who have a very funky, successful business in Bangalore and in Byron Bay. And we just presented the case, you know, have a look at this. Months later, they made a phone call and said, yeah, we want your stuff, Lee. And they've been a wonderful partnership ever since. Wonderful, wonderful people. People started buying Lee's furniture through their outlets, and he became quite well known. And next thing you know, his jewelry is selling, and he's getting more invitations to have his work in other shops. And then he got invited to go to Paris Fashion Week and present his jewelry there.
What a journey.
Oh, look, it's just, and this is in only a couple of years.
Yeah.
And he packed up and away he went. But another great story, you know, he and Alexandria got there and, she's very, very talented with, you know, as young people are with computers and things, and had submitted their application at submission to have a stall there and blah, blah, blah. And so their whole life savings was tied up in a credit card and away they went. And they get to the front door and the lady says, no, you're not registered, you know, and there's all this language issue and stuff. And you can't come in and show your jewelry. Anyway, they asked if they could possibly speak to a manager or somebody who was managing the floor or whatever. And she said, well, by your luck, the organizer of this whole Paris Fashion Week, which is huge, like it's the number one fashion show in the world, he's actually here. I'll go and get him. So along comes the boss of Paris Fashion Week. La, 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 la. Oh, show me what you've got.
Yeah.
Lee opens up this handmade hardwood case that's made out of railway sleepers that he picked up in our back paddock or something, you know. And the guy goes, that's amazing, you're in, come with me. And he walked around the fashion displays everywhere and introduced Lee and Alexandria to everybody.
Yeah.
Now, like, jump forward, they got 35 high-end boutique shops internationally handling
really?
his jewelry.
Awesome.
And then next thing you know, there's celebrities picking it up and showing it to the world.
Was it a wedding ring?
Chris Hemsworth.
It was Chris Hemsworth, right?
Yeah. And Chris is one of, you know, many of the notables in Australia that have bought them. And he's bought a dozen.
That's fantastic.
And, you know, football players and like NBA basketball players. And like every day it's somebody new, you know, is just picking up his stuff, which is amazing. You know, it's just so, so good to watch your kids develop like that. You know,
that's
I'm
great.
So proud of them.
Lou, I really appreciate you coming in and sharing some of your stories. Thank you very much.
Great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening to that podcast as much as I enjoyed talking to Lou. If you would like to share that podcast with other family, friends and members, please feel free to do so on all your social media channels. Tag Conversations in Noosa and point them to the website innoosamagazine.com.au/conversations. If you listen to the podcast via iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Wooshka or Stitcher, please rate and review the podcast. As I mentioned, our podcasts are all available on the In Noosa Magazine website, innoosamagazine.com.au/conversations. I'll give it to you once again. And remember, two fresh podcasts every week, one on Monday and another one on Thursday. Until next time, take care.